8:15, having arrived, I'm going to call the Education Finance Committee to order, and we have a quorum, and if we could have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes.
Representative Newton moves approval of the January 30th, 2013 minutes. Any discussion on that? If not, we have a motion to approve the January 30th, 2013 minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion carry. The minutes are approved. We have former Representative Tom Tilbury. If you would come forward, he has a short presentation. And Representative Tilbury, very nice to see you again.
Good to see you too, Mr. Chair. Good to see the whole committee here this morning, bright and early. And I kind of wanted to keep my comment short because I know you have a heavy schedule this morning. So what I'm here for is I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota School Counselors Association, and I'm emphasizing the role that licensed school counselors play in assisting the children and families of our state throughout their K-12 educational experience. Specifically, I will address those points of the committee specifically related to school counseling services. First, supporting students' performance and helping close achievement gaps was one of the ones that you were looking at. And one of the primary roles that school counselors play inside K-12 schools is addressing student academic needs, particularly when personal, social, and emotional and mental health challenges negatively impact students. It is important to stress that school counselors serve all students in the school setting, not just one particular group, which is why our caseloads and ratios are so high, as has been reported throughout the state. And ever since I came to the legislature in 2007 and passed a bill regarding that, trying to change that. Improving student performance comes in many forms. It happens when school counselors are able to intervene on behavioral issues and reduce discipline problems, which would otherwise lead to a suspension or expelling a student. It happens when school counselors are able to work with classroom teachers to change teaching patterns in the classroom to more effectively assist student learning. Of the student personnel groups assisting students to understand the school-to-work transitions that are needed to establish a career after high school and into post-secondary institution of their choice. For the sake of time, I do have a handout that would help explain that. It talks about the effectiveness of a school counseling program. So, thank you. So I'm hoping that you'd be willing to review that. The second part that I would like to say would just be combining those points 2 and 3 of your committee, of your committee's charge. In terms of funding, licensed school counselors are not funded equitable rates, as are other members of the student services personnel team. Let me say that again. School counselors are not funded or cannot look at getting funding from the special ed program dollars. That is not available to school counselors. They are strictly tied to the general fund budget. So like a social worker or a psychologist, they can tap into those dollars. I don't understand the history about that and how that became, but all of our particular groups of student support services do happen to have the same types of licenses, the same educational qualities and mental health. And as you recall, when we put in the maintenance of effort under the schools Safe Schools levy back in 2007, then it was repealed in 2010, we put that in as student support services as a whole, not just one group against another. And on behalf of the Schools Counselors Association, I'd like to state that never in the time that they've been around looking at this have they ever said, don't fund another group of student support personnel so then we can get funding. All we have ever asked for is having that playing field level along with all the other groups. And I think in light of all of the events that have happened in the past few years, the need for students to have counseling services in their school has been more than ever. And that's not just necessarily towards career, which is what a lot of people remember their counselors for. Maybe they thought of them as a career choice, a person to help them with that. But that is not necessarily the only thing that we do in schools. We talk about social and emotional needs as well. But we do it with all students, not just one category of students. So, I thank you for your time, Mr. Chair, and I'm available for any questions.
Representative Dilberry, thank you for your advocacy and your great advocacy during your days as a legislator for counselors. Appreciate that very much. So, thank you. Thank you.
Hey, Dilberry.
All right, we've got the Minnesota Rural Education Association next. I don't know who wants to go first. Mr. Walseth, if you would introduce yourself and welcome.
Certainly. Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Sam Walseth, the lobbyist for the Minnesota Rural Education Association. I'm here today to introduce the MREA Executive Director, Dr. Fred Nolan. He is a retired superintendent from Foley, Minnesota, and he is going to talk about three strategies for closing the student achievement gap. And so I'll turn it over to Dr. Nolan, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you, Mr. Nolan. Just kind of a reminder for all of the presenters, if we can hold that to about 7 minutes or so we have time for questions, the total presentation, and then we'd have equal time for questions. So thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. As Sam said, I'm Fred Nolan, former Superintendent Foley and Principal and Superintendent in Central Minnesota for 36 years. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. When you're a superintendent and principal, you really look for good ideas, ideas that really are going to matter if you have your staff actually work with them. And so there's three here that I'd like to propose to you, have a track record in Minnesota that are certainly worth examining and replicating. The first is right over here at the University of Minnesota, the Center for Reading Research. Formerly Dr. Taylor Barbara Taylor started this. They have worked with over 50 schools in Reading First and in the Reading Academy, which is federally funded. They now have a press program funded by the Target Corporation with six schools in Minneapolis. And when I say schools, I mean elementary schools, not school districts. There's 920 or so elementary schools and K-12 schools in the state of Minnesota. So they've worked with maybe 5 or 6% of these. So it's a small number, but it's very powerful. Their focus area is on high-quality instruction, tiered interventions, making sure teachers are working in groups and using data. And how does it work? Take a look at Foley. So on the left-hand side in 2007, I can tell you it was there from 2002 to 2010. For the first 4 or 5 years, we couldn't match the state average in proficiency in third grade. Got a new principal. We got into the Reading Academy. Teachers began working together with the coaches from the Reading Academy, and the test scores popped. We're going 88, 90%. That's 15 to 16 kids a year who became more proficient. Every kid counts. And so it takes concerted effort from preschool through kindergarten all the way to third grade to get this, and it makes a huge difference. So what's the center doing now? On the right-hand side, they're working with six schools in Minneapolis. These are very different schools than Foley. They're 77% non-white students, and their proficiency of those six schools after just 1 year was 62% compared to 47% in the control group. If you increase 15% proficiency and your marker is 47%, that's a 30% jump. That's eye-popping. You look down below about how that story impacts each child, and I can tell you stories like that in Foley, but this is a great one from press. The contact information is on the right. By the way, this will be on our website with live links, so you can contact those folks. And if you're in the Minneapolis area, I recommend you take a look at the schools and the University of Minnesota. The second one is the Center for Authentic Intellectual Work. And this work began in the mid-1980s with Dr. Fred Newman at the University of Madison, Wisconsin. And he asked a very simple question. If teachers taught for higher-order thinking skills, would it matter? Everybody wanted to teach for higher-order thinking skills, but it didn't really matter. And so he set out a research program, a very sophisticated one. And the first thing he had to do was figure out how are you going to score teachers' tasks, the instruction, and student work, as to whether it really did teach for higher order thinking skills. And over about 10 years, there was great research. And it came down to three things that mattered: teachers teaching for higher order thinking skills, demonstrating teaching so kids could demonstrate complex understanding, and engaging in work that showed value beyond the school door. If kids could make that connection to the real world, teachers could help them make that connection, they learn more. And that's how come it equips students to address the complex challenges of work, civic participation, and managing personal affairs. It really does happen. How does it happen? It happens when teachers get together in groups and use a scoring manual. This has rubrics in it. You can go to your subject, like science, and find out what the scoring rubric is for your task you give kids, for the work students produce, and for the instruction. You bring video clips. You work in cross-disciplinary groups. You get trust built up, and you score the work, you discuss the work, and then the teachers suggest to their colleague ways to improve the work. They're all secondary teachers. And secondary is one of the most difficult areas to find reform that really works. Okay? So, what shows it? I've got a couple examples. One is a small school, Ogilvy. It was one of the SIG schools. In 2010, it was labeled as one of the persistently failing schools in Minnesota. It was the only school to adopt AIW as their instructional intervention. They did it for 2 years. Twice a week, teachers would gather in small teams, same teams, and go over lessons. It's repetition that makes a difference if you're trying to really learn a new skill. Trust me, I'm trying to learn golf. Sam can attest to that. It takes lots of repetition and good coaching. 2012 results came out with the new MMR. They were number one among the SIG schools. They had an MMR of 70. They're better than 332 high schools in the state of Minnesota. Remember, they were one of the 10 worst 2 years earlier. Okay, they had a focus rating of 90. That's the closing the gap rating. Okay, it was greater than any other SIG schools, and in fact, doubled the SIG MMR. But that's one school, 46 kids in a grade. There's 56% free and reduced lunch kids there, so it's not a wealthy school, but just one school. So let's look at a different study. Iowa, which has gotten into this in a big way by having schools apply to be part of a network of AIW schools, did a very sophisticated matched sample study of 33 high schools and nearly 8,000 students. Okay, so now you've taken all the issues of changeover in kids out of it because you got so many. All right? 11 out of 12 comparisons were more positive, and 8 out of 12 were statistically significant. So let's imagine that this right half of the room were in AIW schools where teachers were meeting in groups for a solid year, all the teachers, and you weren't. And let's also imagine you were all at the 50th percentile of your high school class. Now, that's not true, because I know you're all above the 50th percentile of your high school classes, okay? But just imagine with me for a moment, okay? You all took the Iowa's mandated tests every year. This group, if you look at reading in fourth grade, scored 9.2 percentile points above this group. These schools were matched on socioeconomic status, ethnicity, size, geographic distribution. They tried as best they could to get matched samples in Iowa. So these kids were at the 50th percentile, but they were scoring 9 percentage points above, statistically significantly different. Look at the math line. I don't know how often you look at education research, but to see double-digit gains in mathematics is just astounding. And this isn't a math program. It's a program about how you teach for thinking. Goes on here to tell some great stories. The one in the upper right-hand corner, you might want to look at who's telling the story. When the National Teacher of the Year says her colleagues can help her, something is going on. The final one is, how do you find time for this? If you do find a high-quality program like these two, the first question teachers have for you is, okay, where's the time? Where is the time to get together? We're not talking about after school when you got coaching, or before school when you got meetings or staffings or things like that. Where do you really find the time so everything else can be pushed away? Well, actually, it's very simple. But you got to rethink the weekly schedule for schools and not have the kids come the same time every day. It was recommended in Iowa about 10 years ago. They've been doing it pretty consistently. East Central, another SIG school up on Highway 35, a little north of Hinckley, did it at the beginning of their SIG process. They have their students stay longer, 4 days a week, and go home earlier, 1 day a week. Creates 90 minutes of time for teachers to work together. Doesn't change the salary schedule, doesn't change the teacher's time. Total time, when they come to work, is all the same. It does change the amount of time they have to work together. East Central closed the gap in half in their 10th grade reading scores by doing this. They had a protocol about what they did during that time. You can see that on the right-hand side. And they had a great story about how a teacher had a problem, was able to bring it to the group, get it solved. And I think it's interesting, the quotation from the Iowa staff developer. She couldn't think of a story because it's so routine for them. I mean, he couldn't even think of anything. It's like, it's just normal. It's just routine. We do it all the time. So those would be two high-quality, research-based professional development programs that are working, and a way that all schools can find time for high-quality professional development. And now I'll take questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Erickson, I think we'll have time for one or two questions possibly. So.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt, and welcome both of you. Dr. Nolan is a former superintendent of mine, having been at Foley and moving the students and teachers to points of excellence that really we all should be very proud of. My question for you, Dr. Nolan, is, are these Reading First grants still available through the federal government?
No, they're not. Mr. Chairman, Representative Erickson, no, they're not.
Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. So have you thought of, because I know you're a creative thinker, another funding source that might be available either through the Department of Education or a private funding source that might allow this this kind of program to continue?
Dr. Nolan?
Okay. Chairman Marquardt, Representative Erickson. I know the department has their centers of excellence. And I did ask Lori Hellman, the director of the Reading First, if they're working together, not formally, but some of the centers of excellence are coming to this university for some training. Outside of that, no, unless you reimagine the staff development bill that mm-hmm. has sunsetted, no, I don't have any really creative ideas. I'm thankful that Target Corporation has stepped up in the Twin Cities for the Twin Cities School, for these six schools.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Representative Brainerd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome to our committee, Dr. Nolan. I appreciate your work and your being here, and I think you have some challenging ideas for us. And I have a question that you may not be able to answer, maybe somebody in the audience could, and maybe not today. But what I'm wondering is what type of research is out there comparing various programs that are targeted at higher-order thinking skills? This AIW is one program. I know there are other programmatic approaches to teaching to higher-order thinking skills. And what I want to know, is there any comparative research among those programs? And what else is being done in Minnesota? How many schools are doing AIW right now, and what other programs, and then what comparative data we have? Because I think that would guide us in terms of targeting the most successful among these programs.
Dr. Nolan.
Hey, Chairman Marquardt, Representative Breiner. I can tell you, first of all, where this is also going in the state of Minnesota for AIW. It's currently happening in Roosevelt High School in Minneapolis and in White Bear Lake and in five northern high schools that are in part of a project funded by the Blandin and Northwest Foundation. And those schools are Clearbrook, Gonvig, Bagley, Kellyer, Fisher, and LaPorte. And MREA and AIW are teaming up to work with them. In terms of comparative research, I could suggest to you two sources. One would be Alan Auden's book called 10 Strategies for Doubling Student Performance. Yeah. In there, one of the things he talks about is having a clear instructional point of view is a way of truly increasing achievement. And AIW is an instructional point of view. So is the work from the University of Minnesota, because teachers have a language, they have a way of addressing it. Instructional, they can talk to one another, they can learn from one another. It's really important to get a common language, a common understanding of high-quality instruction. The other one would be John Hattie has a book out comparing 800 meta-studies now, and he has effect size chart, and it's really very interesting. One thing that's limiting for that is if your study wasn't part of a meta-study, it didn't get in his list of 900. And so authentic intellectual work, which is relatively new, given that his work started in the mid-80s, it hasn't been in part of meta-studies, so you won't find it in that comparison. But I'd recommend the John Hattie book to you for the most comprehensive comparison at this point.
Thank you very much. Like all of these, we don't have enough time to really go through it. Thank you so much for your presentation.
Thank you, Chairman and members.
All right, have a good day. Next, Achieve Minneapolis, College and Career Readiness Strategies. Welcome to the committee. If you would introduce yourself.
Thank you very much, Chair Marquardt, representatives and members of the public. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today. My name is Pam Costain. I'm the CEO of Achieve Minneapolis, the independent nonprofit that supports Minneapolis Public Schools. The mission of Achieve is to support career and college readiness for all Minneapolis schools and to provide opportunities for so that every student, regardless of family income, ethnicity, personal circumstance, or zip code, has the same tools, support, and guidance they need to plan for and achieve post-secondary success. We are deeply committed, as you are, to the elimination of our state's shocking achievement gap, a gap which is impacting low-income, minority, and immigrant students in ways that are unacceptable both for the students and the future prosperity of our state. I want to address three issues today. I want to discuss the achievement gap in relationship to workforce development and the economic future of our state. I want to share strategies for career and college readiness that are being implemented in Minneapolis public schools that are making a difference. And finally, I want to discuss a specific policy issue which could have a major impact on secondary education moving forward. Historically, Minnesota has been a national leader in understanding the direct correlation between a highly educated population and economic prosperity. It pays to invest in young people because that investment will return to us tenfold. Minneapolis is home to more Fortune 500 companies per capita than any other city in the nation, due in large part to the knowledge-based economy of our region and the high level of the education of our citizens. Minnesota as a state ranks third in the nation in its need for a highly educated workforce. The often cited 2010 Georgetown Center for Education and Workforce study predicts that by 2018, 70% of all jobs in Minnesota will require a post-secondary education. But unfortunately, supply is not keeping up with demand in our state. As early as 2010, the Governor's Workforce Development Council warned that there is a growing skills gap with enormous implications for Minnesota's economic competitiveness. Across Minnesota, in particular in the Twin Cities, the skills gap is directly linked to the academic achievement gap. People of color are the Twin Cities' fastest growing population. Their numbers increased 38% since 2000 compared to a 3% increase for white citizens. As the demographics of the Twin Cities change dramatically, we are also experiencing the worst economic gap between black and white residents in the nation. And this employment gap is directly correlated to education disparities and the gap in academic attainment. In 2011, 67% of white students graduated in 4 years from the Minneapolis Public Schools, but again, a shocking 38% of black students, 34% of Hispanic students, and 22% of Native students graduated in 4 years. Achieve Minneapolis focuses on increasing career and college readiness and addressing this opportunity gap that exists for many low-income students. I would like to describe three of the most promising strategies we use, which we believe could be replicated across the state. My Life Plan is a curriculum which helps students in grades 6 through 12 develop appropriate academic, post-secondary, and career goals. We have worked closely with the Minneapolis Public Schools to develop and implement this tool, an electronic portfolio of activities and milestones that enables every MPS student to identify their interests, skills, talents, and attributes, and to make appropriate career choices and college choices. 100% of high school students in Minneapolis now access this tool, as do a majority of our middle school students. The U.S. Department of Education has identified 5 key recommendations for students successfully completing high school, and have a college and career plan is one of those 5 key factors. In my opinion, the state of Minnesota needs one consistent planning tool like My Life Plan that can be used by every student in the state and that follows students across grades and across school districts. Such a portfolio would be a key tool for post-secondary success and would provide consistency, guidance, and a set of best practices to be used by all districts. In addition to My Life Plan, Minneapolis has developed a system of career and college centers in every high school. These full-time centers provide a spectrum of services to help students navigate the transition from high school to college and career. They are especially critical for young people whose families have no knowledge or experience with college. They provide the basic infrastructure to support career and college readiness and access, even if those supports did not exist at home. They directly address disparities which compound the achievement gap and provide a place for volunteers in the community to support students as well. Research affirms that providing one-to-one connections for students has proven to have a powerful impact on learning and college readiness. A key activity of the career and college centers in the last few years that I'd like to highlight is the completion of the FAFSA, the Federal Financial Aid Form. The U.S. Department of Education again has identified a direct correlation between completing the FAFSA and attending college the year after high school. As a result, they are doubling down on FAFSA completion to assist low-income students to get to college. In 2011, 79% of the Minneapolis graduating class that completed the FAFSA actually directly went to college. Utilizing the career and college centers as community hubs, volunteers work with students to eliminate these and other barriers to their access to college. The third strategy I'd like to discuss with you today on career and college readiness is to provide more youth access to work experience and internships. Research shows that young people who work are more likely to graduate, less likely to be involved with crime, less likely to become teenage parents, and more likely to achieve greater lifetime earning. Overall, employment, education, and training and job skills equip adolescents with the ability to secure jobs and assist them in becoming self-sufficient adults. Each year, Achieve Minneapolis collaborates with the City of Minneapolis and the private sector to provide more than 1,500 jobs to young people through the Step Up Youth Employment Program. Nearly half of these jobs are employer-paid internships with some of the largest companies in our city. Why is an employment program like Step Up critical to addressing the achievement gap? First, it provides exposure to the world of work, introducing young people to careers that they do not even know exist and opportunities they could never have imagined. This is particularly critical for low-income youth. Second, it trains young people in the soft skills that they need to be successful and that employers decry as absent in so many younger employees today. Skills such as perseverance, teamwork, critical thinking, problem solving, conflict management, appropriate communication, and more. These skills lead not only to success on the job, but also success in school. And finally, internships make the academic work of high school come alive for students, especially those who may be struggling to see the relevance of their high school in their future aspirations. I implore the members of this committee to begin to shape an education system that recognizes work experience and internships is one particularly critical factor in helping to eliminate the opportunity and achievement gap for low-income youth. And finally, and I'm rushing here, I would like to address a policy issue with major implications for the future of high schools, and that is the issue of using seat time as the basis for measuring educational attainment rather than competency-based learning or proficiency. The Alliance for Excellent Education issued a report just this week describing innovative work being done in New Hampshire to rethink the high school experience. As they state, for a century, most students have advanced from grade to grade based on the number of days they spend in class, but New Hampshire schools have moved from seat time toward competency-based learning, which advances students when they have mastered content. Bob Weiss, president of the Alliance for Excellent Education, had this to say. When people are buying a car, they don't ask how long it took to build. Instead, they ask how well it performs. For too long, the nation's education system has promoted students based on how long they sit in the class rather than what they have learned. New Hampshire's experience, although still evolving, holds tremendous promise as an approach for improving student learning outcomes in a system that encourages advancement by demonstrating competency. This issue is critical for the legislature to begin to examine because it has everything to do with how we will organize our high schools for the future. In my opinion, school districts need much more flexibility to meet the needs of 21st century learners. A more open and flexible system based on mastering competencies would allow Minnesota students to utilize internship, community service, and alternative pathways to gain and demonstrate their skills. Our future workforce will need to be highly adept at moving between education and work, between the workplace and the community, between cultures, and between the local and the global. I believe that Minnesota has the will and the resources to address the achievement gap, the opportunity gap, and the gap we have in career and college readiness. But this task will require resources, greater openness to innovation, increased flexibility, and an integrated vision of the connection between school, work, and community. If we want a strong state to live in 5, 10, or 25 years from now, we have to invest in young people now and operate from the belief that each and every one of our youth, regardless of who they are, must be prepared to access additional education and career-oriented opportunities after high school. This is the only path to prosperity for our youth and the only path to prosperity for our state. I thank you for the opportunity to present Achieve Minneapolis's ideas and solutions to you today.
Thank you very much, Representative Morgan.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Ms. Costain, thank you very much for the work that you do on behalf of the students of the state of Minnesota. You know, every year we see students come through Burnsville High School who are gifted and talented in the areas of writing and verbal communication skills. But some of these students also really struggle with math. I'm sure we see this in schools all over the state and vice versa as well. What should we do as a matter of public policy with those students who are really strong and definitely more than college ready in one area of skills and talents, but not so much in another? Are we supposed to hold those kids back to continue a fifth year of high school until they are college ready in math? Or is it better, as we kind of do now, to say, go on to a college, a university setting, where there are some remedial classes available in the areas where you struggle, but you are clearly ready in some of these areas? Which is the better direction to go, Ms. Costain?
Ms. Costain?
Chair Marquardt and Representative, this is dangerous territory for me. It's not, I don't really work in the area of academic preparedness, rather in career and college readiness in other ways. So I will say, personally, I am of two minds. On the one hand, I think we do have to continue to stretch ourselves to expand the expectations that we have of kids. Math is an essential skill in the 21st century. My husband works in alternative energy, and there is nobody working in that field that doesn't need high math skills, and I'm seeing it over and over. So on the one hand, I'm very supportive of the state's move to have higher expectations of kids. I am very, very leery of high-stakes testing, which would prevent kids from getting a high school diploma. And so I don't know. I think you all as legislators balance that, and I think it's a very tricky thing to do. How do we hang on to our commitment to quality but not punish children so that they actually do essentially everything and are not able to exit high school with a diploma? I know it's not a very sufficient answer, but it's all I can give you.
Thank you, Ms. Costain. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate that.
Thank you.
We're going to move to the next group here, Osseo Public Schools, Minnesota Association of School Administrators, and if you would introduce yourselves. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kate McGuire, and I'm privileged to serve as the superintendent for Osseo Area Schools. With me is Dr. Kim Riesgraf, Assistant Superintendent for Administration. Thank you for providing us an opportunity today to speak. Dr. Riesgraf and I are here to talk about the results that we're getting in Osseo Area Schools and to encourage you around a school finance system that provides stable, predictable, and sustainable funding over time. While we'll be giving you some specific examples of why that's important to the practitioners in Osseo Area Schools, we know that the issues that we're addressing are common throughout the state. And as members of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, we'll speak to some of those broader interests as well. Osseo Area Schools boldly declares as its mission to inspire and prepare all students with the confidence, courage, and competence to achieve their dreams, contribute to community and engage in a lifetime of learning. All students in our school district is no small task. We are the fifth largest district in Minnesota, serving more than 20,000 students. And here's what sets us apart from other large suburban school districts in our state. Half of our students are students of color. We serve the third highest number of students of color in the state. We serve the second highest number of Asian Pacific Islander students in the state. Here's why that fact is important to you during your work this session. I believe that if we can shift the racial achievement gap in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Osseo area schools, where we serve more than 28% of all the total number of students of color in the state of Minnesota, that we can shift the face of the racial achievement gap in our state. The key to accomplishing this goal is to ensure equitable student achievement, and that means that we set high standards and work towards high student achievement for all students. And it also means that we accelerate student achievement for those groups that are not meeting our highest expectations and close the racial achievement gap. I want you to know that Osseo Area Schools is getting results that is leading to equitable student achievement gains, that we know what it takes to get those results, and that equitable achievement gains require stable and predictable funding over time. Let me give you three examples of the results that we're getting that's leading to equitable achievement gains. On the back of your handout for our school district, you'll see those three examples. One of our key indicators of results is student proficiency. And proficiency, of course, means the percent of students who meet or exceed the standards set by the state. In reading, from 2008 to 2012, all of our student groups became more proficient, and we saw large increases of 8 to 12% for students of color, which means that we're making progress in closing that achievement gap. All of our students are doing better, and students of color are making the accelerated growth that we need to have them catch up to their higher performing peers. The second data point that shows evidence of success is more of our students are graduating on time. Our on-time graduation rate for Caucasian students is already very high. Over the past 5 years, more of our students of color and more of our students in poverty are graduating on time. In fact, the rate of on-time graduation for our Asian Pacific Islander students has increased 9%, and the rate for our black students has increased 12%. The on-time graduation rates for students in poverty has increased by 6%. I have one more powerful piece of evidence of results related to graduation rates. It's not on the data sheet that I provided to you because the size of the subgroup is too small. However, it's of powerful impact. Our American Indian students are small in number, but they are graduating at rates that are higher than the state average for this group. For the class of 2011, the four-year graduation rate was slightly higher than the state average. But the five-year graduation rate for our American Indian education students in that class was 88.9%. 88.9% for our Native American students. This is over 30 percentage points higher than the state average. A third way that we measure equitable gains is by looking at opportunity. How many of our students are taking the most rigorous coursework that we have available to prepare them for college and careers? Over the past 5 years, student participation in college-level advanced placement and international baccalaureate courses have more than doubled. The increase in participation during that same time period for our students of color tripled. The number of our advanced placement scholars has more than doubled since 2008. We know what it takes to get these kinds of results in equitable student gains. It takes a shared vision for all of our students that has equity at its very core. It takes teachers, people in classrooms with class sizes that are conducive to building the kinds of critical relationships that are necessary with students in order to motivate them to learn. And it takes instructional support staff surrounding those teachers so that they can do their best work. It requires a safe and healthy learning environment. It requires effective instructional practices that continually improve to meet the contemporary needs of our students. It takes early learning in preschool, all-day kindergarten. It takes standards-based instruction, assessment, and grading practices that require teachers to work together to develop common assessments and to allow students multiple opportunities to demonstrate their learning. It takes us using research-based instructional practices proven to have a high effect size. Dr. Nolan referenced that, the Hattie study. It takes culturally responsive curriculum and instruction, specialized programming, some of which you heard today, and other examples like AVID, to support underserved populations in our most rigorous courses. It takes teachers working together in teams, and as a system, it means that we need to examine those practices that are producing the highest equitable achievement gains in our own system, and then sharing those practices across our school district. It takes timely and individualized intervention in behavior and academics when students are not meeting our performance standards in either of those areas. And it takes opportunities to thrive. Students having choices about specialized programs and elective courses to meet their interests. And it takes coaching and professional development that is embedded in our daily practice. We're getting results in equitable student achievement gains, and we know something about what it takes. Over the past 5 years, we've reduced $16 million in expenditures and implemented cost containment measures of more than $800,000. Last November, our operating levy failed by approximately 120 votes out of 68,000 votes cast. As a result, we're headed for another $11 million in expenditure reductions over the next 2 years. That number will climb to more than $14 million if we don't get the same level of integration revenue that we currently receive. Reductions will impact the very things that I just listed and the people that it takes to help us make equitable student achievement gains and to accelerate those gains to close the racial achievement gap. Osseo area schools, with the third highest number of students of color in the state of Minnesota, we'll be reducing support for the very practices that are helping us get equitable achievement gains. And we need your help. I've asked Dr. Reese Graff to share a few pieces of specific information from our legislative platform to help you understand the impact that you can have this session.
Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you. First of all, we've got about 2 minutes, if you could limit that. And Dr. McGuire, thank you so much. This is excellent. Excellent data here, and I know we've got a couple questions, so if we could, a couple minutes, go ahead.
Yep, I'm really quick.
Okay.
All right. Just that we want to encourage you this session to look at how you can allocate resources through an understandable statewide formula that rationally relates to educational need. So some of the specific points that we would support and endorse is looking at the special education cross-subsidy for our school district. That's $21 million. And to reduce the amount that we must take from our general fund to help with special education, which is an incredibly important service we provide our students. The other is to link the basic formula amount to an annual inflationary rate. We've tried very hard to contain costs, but there is inflation, and we think that would help us have a sustainability in our programs. To reform the compensatory funding and integration revenue as recommended by the MDE Education Finance Work Group, to continue and strengthen programs like QComp that have been essential for us in our teacher professional development and helping coach our teachers, to give school boards the authority to renew existing levies when they expire. And the last thing that we'd like to emphasize is funding voluntary all-day kindergarten and preschool programs. We use our Title I dollars to provide preschool options for our students at our three of our Title I schools.
Let me see the thing. Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Dr. McGuire, and would you, I don't know if you introduced yourself, for the record, please.
I'm Dr. Kim Reesgraff, and I'm the Assistant Superintendent of Administration for Osseo Area Schools.
Thank you. Dr. McGuire.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we want to thank you for your kind attention and for your service, and we want to thank you for the opportunity to share information. We're happy to answer questions that you might have now. We also hope that you'll call us at any time if you have questions about the impact of your work on teaching and learning.
Thank you, and you've got contact information here on your handout, too.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Selzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. McGuire and Dr. Rees-Graff, thank you for the tremendous presentation, the great work that you are doing. It's amazing. I do have a question. You referenced the 5-year graduation rate of your Native American population. And I know there's with students from a challenging economic background, there's often a high degree of mobility. I'm wondering if you have tracked the 5-year graduation rate of other student population at risk, and if there is a similar dramatic increase.
Dr. McGuire?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't have that specific data.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Yep. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. McGuire, what is the portion of your licensed staff that is non-classroom? I know in past years when we discussed Minneapolis and other districts, they've got a portion of their staff working on curriculum and other activities. So I was just curious what portion of your licensed staff is not in the classroom.
Dr. McGuire.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can't give you the specific percentage. I can tell you this. We have approximately 1,600 licensed staff members. Of those licensed staff members, obviously the majority of them are in classrooms in direct instruction. However, we do have investment in instructional support staff that surround teachers because they need that in order to do their best and most effective work. Counselors, social workers, teachers on special assignment who help to do professional development and help teachers work with assessment and research best practices and share those best practices. But by far, I think the greatest percentage of licensed staff members is certainly in the classroom. It's why the impact of our budget reductions will be so significant. The magnificent programs that you're hearing described here today by several presenters will not reach the capacity of the impact that we intend if we do not have human beings called teachers in the classrooms with class sizes conducive to implementing those programs and building the critical relationships that are necessary for learning. It won't make any difference.
Very good. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quickly, I'm really impressed with the comprehensive articulation of the comprehensive approach that the district has, and what I really like about what I'm hearing is that we seem to have leadership in the Osceola School District that's gotten away from sort of counting beans, the input side of structuring education delivery, really focused on results. And obviously there's lots of different moving pieces in here that all need to be integrated. And so I would add that I think one of the pieces perhaps you didn't mention, at least I didn't hear, is that it requires really focused leadership. And I want to thank you for providing that and for your staff. And I have lots of questions, but I know we don't have time. I'm just wondering, Mr. Chair, perhaps we could ask the superintendent to provide a written statement of your testimony, because I thought it was a very useful framework for us to focus on, particularly as we think about how all these pieces that we provide distinct funding for, like integration aid, how those fit in, and so that we don't lose track of that. It'd be great to have your testimony in written fashion.
Dr. McGuire, would you be able to provide that to the committee?
Mr. Chair, I can have that to you by this afternoon.
No, that's it. That doesn't surprise me one bit after I looked at this data that you'd have it back so soon. So. Thank you so much for your wonderful presentation.
Thank
you. All right, next, Minnesota Business Partnership, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Good morning.
Good morning.
You would introduce yourself and please begin.
Chair Marquardt and members of the House Education Finance Committee, my name is Amy Wallstein. I'm the Director of Education and Workforce Development Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Jim Bartholomew from the Minnesota Business Partnership and I appreciate the opportunity to present to the committee today on closing student achievement gaps and raising overall student achievement for Minnesota students. Closing the achievement gap is of critical importance to the business community and for all Minnesotans. Demographics are changing in Minnesota, as we know. More of our workforce needs to reach higher levels of education to be successful. yet an increasing number of Minnesotans are in demographic groups that have a more difficult time accessing and completing those levels of education. The challenge is how we strengthen the education to workforce pipeline so that achievement levels of all students are being raised to world-class standards. Among those improvements, better alignment of the E-12 system with post-secondary education. Specific to this point is what we wanted to touch on today. Where we are significantly out of alignment between E-12 and post-secondary is on expectations for high school completion that align with expectations for post-secondary entrance, and specifically on assessments. As we work toward improvement of student outcomes, we must measure what students are learning in a way that provides the best data for continuous improvement of student learning. Assessments are a tool. They help educators and students know how well information is being mastered. And assessments provide valuable feedback to the system on its effectiveness and alignment along the P20 spectrum. Commissioner Casilius formed a working group last year to examine how effective our current system of assessments is. And one area where it was clear our system is falling short is that measurement of the transition from high school to college. The tests that are required for graduation, the grad tests that are delivered in math, reading, and writing, measure the knowledge students have acquired but are not doing a good job, as good a job as they could, measuring whether students are ready for post-secondary. The issue with the math grad is not new, but it's not improving. So what the task force looked at is working backwards from college career readiness and designing an assessment system that aligns. So as the working group set forth in their report, which I'm hoping the committee examines at some point in more depth, there is much benefit for Minnesota in moving towards a comprehensive assessment system focused on college readiness. If we are working towards alignment of K-12 and post-secondary, that expectation should be, what is that level? At what point is a student ready for and won't require remediation in post-secondary? Simply put, too many students are graduating underprepared. The Getting Prepared report that was released in 2010 demonstrated that 40% of students entering the MNSCU system are requiring remediation, and it's closer to 50% in math. Remediation is very costly, and it deters students from actually completing college. And so that's the pressure on the post-secondary side of it. But on the high school side of it, it is high-stakes examinations, as Pam Costain alluded to in her testimony. And to that point, it is important that we have in place multiple methods to demonstrate college readiness. And one such measure must continue to be individual student performance, such as on a cumulative exit exam, an end-of-course exam in a core subject area, or a college readiness placement exam, such as the ACT, SAT, or AccuPlacer. 25 states now are using exit exams, and that's anticipated that that's going to increase, and the rigor will increase as the Common Core assessments come online. So we're encouraging a hard look at placement tests such as AccuPlacer, ACT, SAT. They've established benchmarks that and have the research behind them to demonstrate that the scores correlate to success in college. High school graduation is a milestone, and expectations for what graduation means must be clear to students. And as we work on strengthening that pipeline, there are several other areas that Jim will go into, areas in which we feel that there are common practices used by high-performing schools.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. As Ms. Wallstein described, the first step in helping all students succeed is to establish clear expectations for what high school students should know and be able to do to graduate. And I'll describe a set of common characteristics used by high-performing schools and the actions we'd recommend to help schools implement these or adopt them more broadly. As background, the common characteristics are a summary of findings from international as well as U.S.-based research projects. Interestingly, these characteristics are very consistent with what the Business Partnership has learned through our recognition program of high-performing, high-poverty schools in Minnesota. In fact, that may be our strongest message today, that despite our deep and persistent student achievement gaps, we have schools around the state that are doing a tremendous job of helping all students succeed. Our challenge is helping other schools adopt these characteristics. The characteristics are in the middle of the back page of our handout. And not surprisingly, the first two focus on the importance of school leaders and teachers. And generally speaking, the high-performing schools have an effective leader who is able to build a team and create a culture of success. The schools have teachers and staff who are committed to the school's mission and strategies and have ongoing professional development opportunities. Their instruction is aligned with standards. They conduct frequent assessment of student progress and provide immediate interventions as needed. They have strategies to involve families in building support for student success, and they create as much instructional time as possible. From a legislative perspective, what are some of the actions we'd recommend to help schools adopt these characteristics on a more broad basis? The first two items contribute to the actions, to the characteristics of developing effective teachers and leaders. And the first is the implementation of the 2011 laws for principal and teacher evaluations. Both of these were based on research showing the positive impact of effective educators on student performance. And with the evaluation results, we can strengthen teacher and principal professional development opportunities, including funding for the Principal's Leadership Academy. Third, as educator performance data becomes more available, it should play a more significant role in district and school decisions about placements to better meet student needs. Fourth, we should continue to create opportunities for educators by strengthening our charter school and self-governed school laws. Fifth, continue development of the state's Longitudinal Educational Data System, or SLEDS, so we can identify successful programs and practices. And we should continue implementation of the Parent Aware Quality Rating System and the related early education scholarships for low-income families. By setting clear expectations for what students need to know, as Ms. Wallstein pointed out, and supporting opportunities for schools to adopt successful practices, we can help all students be prepared for a global economy. And thank you.
Thank you so much. Representative Radinovich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a question for Ms. Wallstein. While a lot of the goals and practices you outlined, I certainly could agree with. When I talk to the school districts in my area, I live in Crowing in Aiken County, a lot of very small schools. And one thing that they continually bring up to me is the premise that all students will be prepared for college. I think that we can all agree on a post-secondary route, but one you know effect that we've seen is that with mandates for instance, a chemistry class at those schools that already have a small amount of teachers, they are under financial stress, and they serve a population that you know, a lot of their parents work with their hands. I mean, it's a different environment. And so I think the concern is that while we mandate classes like chemistry, that we're losing opportunities in the industrial technology departments and in non-core, or what we would call non-core curriculum. Could you, and furthermore, I think that, you know, post-secondary education in those fields at Minnesota's technical colleges and vocational colleges is an important part of developing the workforce that we're going to need for the future. So could you speak to that and, you know, what your position is on that?
Ms. Wallstein.
Chair Marquardt, Representative Radinovich. As we are looking at, as we're talking about college readiness, we've kind of changed the way we've talked about that to incorporate post-secondary readiness, because I think that what we're seeing through labor market data is that that's the skill set, those are the jobs that are where we're going to have some shortages in the next decade in particular, you know, up to 100,000 jobs, particularly in middle skill areas. And as we talk with MinSCU and the other institutions that are preparing for the middle skill jobs, what they tell us is that, you know, math and science needs to be at a baseline level so that they aren't requiring remediation. And I've heard anecdotally that the math preparation for some of the tech programs needs to be as rigorous as it does for a four-year program. As we're looking at these new industrial tech jobs, they're different than they were several years ago, and they require a higher level of math and science preparation as well as reading. Some of the technical manuals are at very high levels of understanding.
Representative Radenovich?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Wallstein. And, you know, while I can get behind that idea, I guess, the concern for me is that when you mandate classes, that you're denying students the opportunity to learn in a different fashion, and that, you know, I think that when you mandate classes like chemistry, what you're assuming is that, or some of these math classes, that all students will learn math in the same way, or that they, that some, or perhaps maybe a better way to say it is that there are some students who would learn math better in a different setting. Could you speak to that? And if you were recommending policy to the legislature or this body here to implement that, you know, values those what you call middle skill jobs, what would that be?
Ms. Wallstein?
Chair Marquardt and Representative Radenovich, I think what we see is that delivery of education in different fashions is very helpful. And kids acquired knowledge in different ways. And requiring classes without some flexibility, I can see where that is definitely a concern. So I think some of the work that was done last year by the legislature to expand career and tech to different methods of delivering that education through different courses was very helpful, and we'd like to continue to work on that.
I think I'm going to, okay, Mr. Bartholomew, if you could quickly.
Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Radenovich, I echo that in the sense that the state is required a set of standards, not particular classes, with the idea that those standards can be taught in a variety of ways to kids, whichever is most appropriate for them. And I think Ms. Wallstein's right in the sense that as the legislature, for example, has expanded the ways that vocational technical education can satisfy certain science standards, for example, is a good way of trying to recognize those different approaches to the same goal.
Thank you. Representative Van Zelk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It might actually surprise you to learn that I'm pleased to hear that your organizations and I assume your members recognize that there are high-performing districts in Minnesota, and that of recent times there are some initiatives that the legislature has taken that are actually making a positive contribution to youngsters and to your members' need for highly educated, qualified workers. But that's kind of where it ends for me. I equate high-performing districts with districts that I define as being silk stocking. And I see not only an achievement gap, but a gap between high-performing schools that are wealthy and medium and low-performing schools that are poor. Now, your organizations can provide the citizens of Minnesota with a tremendous boost. We can accomplish a lot this session if your organizations will support comprehensive, sustainable, stable, fair, balanced funding of public education, regardless of property wealth, regardless of geography, and regardless of community values. What's your position on the governor's budget recommendations, and what's your position of your organizations on balance and moving toward, once again, funding of public schools that's balanced, so that a kid in Bacchus is able to come close to the same quality education that is more readily providable in some of the wealthier districts in Minnesota's suburbs.
For the sake of time, I'm going to limit that question down.
I made my point.
Thank you. Maybe Ms. Wallsteiner, Mr. Bartholomew, just even on this equity issue between the, I mean, where do we kind of stand? How would you look at maybe solving, you know, where you've got the poorer districts that may not have as good a chance versus the wealthier district to have better opportunities? And if you could just address that.
Well, I'll,
thank you,
Mr. Chair, members. On the outset, I think it's important to recognize that the state funding formulas give each district a different amount of money, primarily based on their characteristics, and that's appropriate. So in the sense that we'll have the same dollars for all kids, regardless of where they are, is not a place to start. There are differences, and we should recognize those. In terms of equity beyond that, I'm presuming you're talking then about referendums, and to the degree it seems that improving the equalization formulas for districts and referendums would be a good place to start.
Very good. Oh, you know, we have five more people on the list, and we have two more presentations, so I'm sorry we're going to have to cut this off. Thank you so much for your presentation. Next, North St. Paul Public Schools, all-day kindergarten. And this presentation with questions need to end at 9:35. I've promised 10 minutes to the last presentation. Do we have North St. Paul Public Schools?
It is the question.
Okay, Representative Grunhagen, if you can just stay right there, yep. If you would like to, please proceed.
Hey, thank you, Chair Marquardt. I sincerely appreciate the time to be able to present this information, and I will try to do it quickly and within 10 minutes of the valuable committee time. There's a packet there. The title is Self-Actualization, Becoming a Feeling-Centered Decision Maker. I'm not asking that you agree with this information. I simply want you to understand the technique behind self-actualization. The first two pages are just a guide. You can skip to the fourth page, and you'll see a picture of Dr. W.R. Colson, Carl Rogers, and Dr. Abe Maslow. Dr. Colson worked with Dr. Rogers and Dr. Maslow to introduce the concept of self-actualization into the public schools. They brought in the terminology of facilitation and encounter groups. That teachers are facilitators rather than educators. They introduced that out in California in the late 50s, early 60s. The concept of self-actualization can be understood rather simply by, instead of using what you know to be right and wrong, or what you've been taught to be right and wrong first, and your feelings second to make a decision, they wanted to reverse that. You use feelings first and what you know to be right and wrong second. Once you were able to reorientate an individual on how they made a decision from feelings versus objective truth, they called that concept self-actualization. Terminology that goes with self-actualization would be pop psychology, or if it feels good, do it. Okay, those of us old enough to remember that phrase in the late 60s. That originated out of this type of humanistic psychology that was introduced into education, again, out in California. Now, how do they reorientate children in the classroom? Okay, and I've got several examples of curriculum in front of you. If you turn to page 3 on the handout there, this is a sixth grade sex education program, and I that was used in the 90s in our local public school. It asked the child what's okay and what's not about teenagers seeing R and X-rated movies or reading pornographic magazines. Again, this was to a sixth grader. So what humanistic psychology believes is that values are relative, okay? Everybody needs to decide for themselves what's right or wrong. They don't need to be told directly what's right or wrong. So therefore, they pose questions to a sixth grader who's probably been told by his parents not to watch R and X-rated movies or look at pornographic magazines. Culture also says to the sixth grader, it's illegal for you to do so. But the curriculum comes along and makes the suggestion to the sixth grader what's okay and what's not about seeing R and X-rated videos. Look down at question three. What's okay and what's not about swearing and slang? So it begins to introduce to the child the idea that there are some positive reasons for doing negative behavior. Okay, that's the sex ed. Then if you turn the page, you look over at drug ed, okay? This is the pyramid of needs right in the curriculum Dr. Abe Maslow developed. And then inside that drug curriculum, there's an emotion clock. This is an exercise, again, used during the 90s to get children to start using their feelings, making decisions first, rather than what they know to be right and wrong, what they've been taught, to reorientate the child. You can see they give them a little situation, and I didn't include that, feeling, reason, time. Feeling, reason, time. You know, Dr. Nolan said repetition. This drug curriculum continually repeats this idea of feeling, reason, time. Again, this is a sixth grade curriculum. Turn to the next page, page number six, and I didn't include the situation card, but they give the child a situation that they have to make a decision on, and then the child under PITS has to have thought, feeling, action. Thought, feeling, action. Thought, feeling, action. That's how they begin to reorientate children into a self-actualized, feeling-centered decision-maker, okay? Now, here's another example. Again, sixth grade. My sister's boy was in sixth grade. That's how I got so much of this information. This situation one talks about Johnny with his friends who have some marijuana. And the other boys are trying hard to get Johnny to go and smoke marijuana with them. So the question is, what should Johnny do? Turn the next page. Page number eight is a decision-making tree. You start at the bottom. Step one, identify the situation. Again, this is to sixth graders, which is whether to smoke the marijuana or not. Step two, look at alternative courses of action. In other words, again, there's no right or wrong. Everybody has to decide for themselves. So the two alternatives is to smoke the marijuana or not smoke the marijuana. Well, under smoke the marijuana, then you have to go to step three. You have to write a negative reason for smoking the marijuana, but then you have to write a positive reason for smoking the marijuana. So a sixth grader is suddenly introduced to the concept of writing a positive reason for something society and his parents and the police have told him not to do. Okay? And step four is decide on the best possible action, and step five is evaluate the results. Well, if you overdose on drugs, you could be splattered all over the road dead, or you could die of over drug use. So you might never get to step five. Okay. The third example was introduced to eighth graders. It's written by humanistic psychologist Howard Kirschenbaum. It's about a woman who wants to get across a river of people eating alligators. Again, all this curriculum was used in my home district. Okay, I didn't get this off of the internet. This was actually in the classroom in my home district. She prostitutes herself to get across the river, and her fiancé is mad about that, and she leaves him. And, of course, you can read the questions. This was a public health curriculum, TEP program. Turn to the next page, and I'm covering this rather quickly. I could talk about 10 hours on this. We'll keep it to 10 minutes, okay? This is where it's done in so-called suicide or death education. Again, They're given little stories, and you can see by the answer number two, the answer in the story is Joel had dared his friend Tony to swim out to a rock. Tony drowned. This is the gist of the story. I don't have it in here. And so therefore, again, a sixth grader, this happened to be my secretary's son who brought this curriculum home, the answer the child wrote out of the little story was, well, Joel has two options, to kill himself or hide forever. The teacher scored it zero wrong, 100%. Okay? This type of, and then he had to write his own tombstone. His name was Brian. He also wrote a tombstone for his brother Chris. And he had to fill out his own obituary. And you can see he was 12 years old when he died. This type of curriculum, again, is based on humanistic psychology. It, according to the American Psychological Association, these types of courses actually can increase the incidence of children considering suicide rather than reduce it, which is what the curriculum is supposed to be designed for. Okay, the next page, page 12, is the ideal parents. Read, those are written by sixth graders. One of those two sixth graders is self-actualized. The other one isn't. I'd encourage you to read over. It's relatively easy to figure out who got self-actualized, okay? But it's interesting read. The next page, 13, is a summary of what Dr. Coulson and Abe Maslow, by the way, Dr. Maslow, both Maslow and Coulson later on wrote apologies for promoting this into the schools. And here are the effects of teaching this type of education to the children. One is, and again, this is summarized from by Dr. Coulson, who I corresponded and got to know over a 5 to 6 year period. It promotes disrespect for authority. You also have a decline in discipline. In other words, it encourages poor discipline. You have a decline in academics. It promotes self-centeredness. Everybody can decide for themselves what's right or wrong. Number five is the most interesting. The results of this type of education, and this is what Coulson, Maslow, and Rogers found as they went from one public school to the next out in California. They thought that tobacco use, alcohol, and illegal drugs and promiscuous behavior would decline with this technique. Yet every time they looked back on their control groups, they found that among young people, just the opposite was true. Tobacco, alcohol, illegal drug, and promiscuous behavior increased. Okay? I'll let you read the rest of the results yourself. The next page...
Representative Grunhagen, you've got about 30 seconds.
Okay. Thank you. Then we'll skip right to the... there's several more articles in there about direct instruction. I do want to bring this up. Page number 18. I had a lot of doubts about what Dr. Coulson had been telling me, but he told me to call the Tobacco Institute in Washington, D.C., and order their drug curriculum, which they'll send you for free as a parent to teach to your child. I did that. That's a copy of the envelope it came in. When they send you the curriculum, helping youth decide, it tells you to teach your child basically to become a feeling-centered decision-maker. Anywhere in the school district where you see the words critical thinking and decision-making, they're promoting self-actualization, especially in drug and sex education. The place where critical thinking and decision-making should be taught is in science or origins, not in drug and sex education or suicide education. The final comment is, again, the book by the former president of the American Psychological Association, which you can order online, written 2005, Destructive Trends in Mental Health, The Well-Intentioned Path to Harm. He talks about labeling and drugging of children. Humanistic psychology has affected our reading programs. It's affected our drug and sex ed programs, and it is undermining both the effectiveness and cost of our public educational system. I hope to work bipartisanly on the results of this if other people are concerned. And there's also a study on U.S. Department of Education back in the late 80s looking at 50 different reading programs. A phonetic-based program costs $30 to teach a child by the fourth grade to read. Whole language or basic literature costs on average $214 per child. With that, Mr. Chairman, I thank you for your time, and If someone has questions, I'm fine. Otherwise, look forward to you reviewing this materials and see if we can do something about the promotion of self-actualization in our public schools. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Any members have any questions, please see Representative Grunhagen after the meeting. So, thank you. If we could move to North St. Paul Public Schools, all-day kindergarten. And we're going to have about 12 minutes till the end of the meeting. So if you would introduce yourselves and welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chair Marquardt, members of the committee. My name is Jim Miklosich, and I'm the principal of Richardson Elementary School in North St. Paul.
Hi, I'm Jenna Peters, and I'm an instructional coach and teacher in North St. Paul at Richardson Elementary.
Okay.
I'm Dylan Sanders, kindergarten teacher at Richardson Elementary, District 622.
Very good. Who wants to start?
I'll start.
All right.
We are here today from the North St. Paul Mayport Oakdale Schools to speak to you about the proven benefits of all-day kindergarten. We know that you are looking for data-driven ways to close the achievement gap and make all Minnesota students more prepared to compete in the global economy. I believe it was this committee that indicated their goal was to close the achievement gap by 50% over the coming years, and hopefully today we can provide information to you that will show that we've been making strides towards that in our school district. We're also going to talk to you a little bit about the structural differences between all-day K and half-day K so that you can see where the increase in rigor comes from, and then we'll also highlight our data. To tell you a little bit about us, North St. Paul Maplewood Oakdale is an inner-ring suburb that has seen great change in the past 12 years. We are a middle-class community that has experienced a rapid rise in poverty and diversity. You have graphs in front of you that will show that from 2000 to 2006, our kindergarten students receiving a free or reduced lunch and students of color doubled from 12 to 25%. These are the students who are traditionally represented in the achievement gap and students who are overrepresented in costly special education programming. During this six-year span, we had elementary test scores that trailed the state MCA averages in both reading and math, and we were also facing yearly budget cuts due to a lack of funding. In 2007, with our district budget continuing to tighten, we made the decision to move to universal free all-day kindergarten. Our internal measures immediately began to show growth in first grade reading scores. 3 years later, the trend began to impact our MCA scores. Slowly, all of our scores have begun to rise, and we've now surpassed the state in the area of math, and we've nearly caught the state in the area of reading. All of our achievement gaps have begun to close, and we've been able to reduce special education counts. These numbers were recorded as our free and reduced lunch population once again doubled. Today, if you were to come to the North St. Paul schools, you would find that over 50% of our kindergartners are on a free or reduced lunch or students of color. The changing demographics of our district and shrinking resources would typically spell achievement disaster. But with the support of a rigorous, well-planned all-day K program, 622 has beaten the odds at the elementary grades. Jenna Peters, teacher and instructional coach, would now like to share with you the differences in all-day K and half-day K that have led to this shift in achievement.
Very good. Ms. Peters.
Hi. Thank you. Again, my name is Jenna Peters, and if you look at slide 4 on our presentation, you can see the differences between a full-day program and a half-day program, and rigor is the key. In a full-day program, teachers have the necessary time to teach the rigor of our Common Core and academic standards, and this rigorous instruction is what is helping us to close our achievement gaps. Because we have higher academic standards for our students, kindergarten has changed drastically over the last decade or so. While it's still a place where kids come to learn important social skills and work habits, it's also a place where developing our early academic skills becomes crucial to later learning success. When you take a look at our full-day and half-day programs, you'll see that many of the components are similar, but when you take a closer look, you can see that in a full-day program, teachers are able to provide instruction at a much deeper level. For example, if you look at reading instruction, you can see that the components of reading instruction in a full-day program are happening daily. Word work, shared reading, read aloud, reader's workshop, those all happen every single day in a full-day program, whereas in a half-day program, those components are shared across a week. The same can be said for small group instruction. Kindergarten teachers in an all-day, everyday program are able to provide targeted small group instruction daily to students for about 35 to 40 minutes each and every day, which is about 2 to 3 groups each day. Whereas in a half-day program, they're limited to small group instruction just a couple of times a week. Essentially, the amount for targeted instruction in small group is cut by 2/3 in a half-day program. In our district, we've also seen dramatic growth in the area of math. And when you compare math instruction in an all-day kindergarten program to that of a half-day program, you'll see that the time devoted to math instruction increases by almost double in a full-day program. If you look to slide 5, it shows the number of hours students spend in kindergarten across the year. In a half-day program, it's about 435 hours. And in an all-day kindergarten program, it's closer to 1,200 hours. The term half-day is somewhat misleading because really when you look at it, it's really cut by about two-thirds in a half-day program. And as you move on to slide 6, it shows the minutes kindergartners spend in a day, 390 minutes in a full-day program versus 150 in a half-day. And what I really would like to point out there is how academics are cut. If you look at the full-day program and you look at the blue and yellow and gray bars compared to the half-day program, you can see that reading is cut by about two-thirds, math is almost cut in half, and writing is cut by close to 80%. Moving on, if you look at slide 7, there's added value to having a full-day program. Kids in a full-day kindergarten program in our district receive specialist time every day in STEM, phys ed, or music. There's opportunity for early intervention in kindergarten in our full-day program. There's increased time for social and emotional activities, opportunities for play and less structured time with peers, and then they receive breakfast and lunch at school. In essence, the key difference between a full-day and a half-day program is the academic rigor. The half-day program, the opportunity to provide rigorous academic instruction is greatly diminished. And as you can see, in a full-day program, opportunity for teachers to provide high academic rigor balanced with the social and emotional skills needed in kindergarten makes it possible for us to shift our student achievement.
If I could ask you to look now to slides 8 and 9. Those are graphs of how students performed on the MCAs in third grade in 2000, from 2006 to 2012. You'll notice the gray line that goes across the top are the students that are in the all-day, everyday kindergarten program. In the middle, you'll notice a yellow line that ends in 2009. That yellow line ends in 2009 because until 2006, we offered half-day kindergarten for some students. You will notice that the students in ISD 622 that had the all-day experience typically outperformed their peers by anywhere from 5 to 15% on the MCAs. The blue line across the bottom are students who come to us after kindergarten, typically from districts not offering the all-day program. And again, you can see the wide gap in achievement between those students who have the all-day experience and those who do not. Moving on to slides 10 and 11, we talked a little bit about gap closure. These are slides based on the 2010 MCAs, which was the last year that we had a significant pool of students who had the all-day and half-day experience. You'll notice in the area of reading, students of Asian descent scored 17% higher if they had all-day K than if they were in half-day K. And you'll notice that those trends continue on down with our African-American and Hispanic students. If you move on to slides 12 and 13, you'll notice that that trend bears out very similarly in math, with all of our subgroups performing 7 to 25% higher on the MCAs if they've had the opportunity to participate in all-day K.
Delene Sanders, after hearing all the data and reasons for all-day kindergarten funding is needed, I'm here to tell you why our young learners need to continue to have all-day kindergarten. For most children from low-income families, their parents would love to give their children the early experience of learning at preschool, but most cannot afford it. Their children start kindergarten already behind their peers who have already had early education and the structure needed to be ready for kindergarten. All-day kindergarten gives children that did not have early education experience the time to gain the skills, the structure, and the rigor that will help them to close the achievement gap that they have already started in kindergarten. They're already behind. These children deserve the time, the rigor, and the structure of all-day kindergarten that it provides for them. It gives them a good foundation for future learning. If you look at slide 15, where does Minnesota stand? In America, 67% are in all-day kindergarten. In Minnesota, 31% are in all-day kindergarten.
A few facts that we'd like to leave you with. In ISD 622, it costs our district $1.25 million a year to fund all-day kindergarten. This is $1.25 million more than the half-day experience, which is currently being funded. Since we've implemented this program, our district has cut $23 million from its budget, but I'm proud to say all-day kindergarten has never even been debated as possibly being a budget cut. It makes me very proud that my secondary colleagues, high school principals and middle school principals, don't even put this on the table when that $1.25 million could impact their class sizes. We've been able to improve our MCA performances. We've been able to close racial achievement gaps, and we've done this with increased class sizes because of the lack of funding at the state level. And last but not least, I'd like you to take a look at this graph. The blue line would be where we were at in student achievement in 2007, which was the year we started All Day K. Last year, 2012, was the first year that we had third, fourth, and fifth graders who had all been through our All Day K program. You will notice by looking at the graph that we've raised our student achievement by almost 8% in the area of reading, and gaps have been closed by anywhere from 8% all the way up to 20%. We've done all of this while our free and reduced lunch and minority populations have more than doubled once again. The final thing I'll leave you with is, as we began to see these changes, our special education counts began to rise rapidly. Now that we have a group of K-5 students who've all had the all-day K experience, we are beginning to see those special education numbers drop. And we have 1% fewer students in special ed right now, K-5 in our district, than we had in 2006 when we began the program. Thank you very much time today, and we welcome your questions.
Thank you very much. Time for one quick question. Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last week, the committee discussed briefly Head Start, and there's recent data showing that Head Start does a strong job in preparing low-income children for school, but that the schools seem to be struggling then in maintaining that high level of performance that the children walk in the door with. I would imagine you have the same challenge with all-day kindergarten. What did you do then to change first, second, and third grade curriculum and instruction to maintain the strength that the children walking into first grade after all-day kindergarten came in with?
Great question.
Thank you. Chair Marquardt and Representative Dabney, it is a great question. One of the biggest things that we've done, and we have data to support this as well, is we raised all of our benchmarks, in particular in reading. We give an assessment called the DRA, which is the Developmental Reading Assessment. Typically, we would expect a kindergartner to leave at a level 2. We've now raised that to a minimum of a level 4, with the goal being a level 6, and we've been able to move all of our benchmarks up at each grade level respectively. And we've been able to track that internally, and we can see that at each grade level, students are reading at a higher level, and also on our internal math measures, which are also developed curricular assessments, we continue year in and year out to see students performing at a higher level. We haven't necessarily had to adjust the curriculum, but we've had to adjust our instruction, raise our expectations, and I think higher expectations are just, you know, something we can all agree upon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you to all the presenters today, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
Excellent things, some excellent progress, excellent data. Thank you. Members, have a great weekend. We are adjourned.
Super Bowl Sunday. Oh, there's more.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Oh, I did. Oh, good.
Thank you. Oh, yeah, I got it.
Why would you ask a sixth grader what's okay and what's not?
Yeah.
Yes. Think about it.
Yeah. All right. Oh.
She said she was having one of them either.
Oh, yeah, I recognize that building. Who is that one? Yeah, we're going to. That's your enamel, too.
No, I think that's, you know, for a lot of areas. That's,
oh, yeah.
But if you look at the difference in the math.
Glad to help. Anytime.
Reading,
let me know what you need.
I think if you look at ELA.